You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway.
You're listening to the Producer's Perspective Podcast with your host, Tony Award winner, Ken Davenport.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. This is Ken Davenport, and you're listening to the Producer's Perspective podcast, and we're very lucky to have as our guest today, fresh off a red eye from Denver, Colorado, where he just opened the national tour of Dear Evan Hansen, four-time Tony-nominated director Michael Greif. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
So, Michael made his Broadway debut. Is this true your Broadway debut was Rent?
Oh, yeah.
So, that little show that no one has ever heard of. Also, on his extensive resume, Grey Gardens, Next to Normal, If Then, War Paint, Dear Evan Hansen, as I mentioned, and many more. Two of the musicals he's directed have won the Pulitzer Prize. So I'm going to start there. You have a knack, obviously, for finding material that really resonates not only with the public, but also with those high and mighty critics, awards committees, etc. How do you go about choosing material?
Mostly it's really about stories that interest me, told in interesting ways. And I must say that since Rent, sometimes stories and projects pursue me. So that's also part of it. So I'm in the luxurious position of being able to be asked to look at a lot of material. Sometimes I have people help me look at material, but more often than not, I'm able to actually take a look myself. And certainly in terms of Next to Normal and Dear Evan Hansen, those are projects that I was invited to take a look at and interview, meet the writers, meet the producer, talk about what my ideas might be, talk about what part of the material I responded to most, which parts I responded to least, get a sense of if the collaborators were open to a change, being able to change in their process. So those sorts of things. But certainly among the most successful or the projects that you mentioned, I was invited. I didn't go seek them out. I happily was invited. And then I'm also very happy to say that I needed to go through a process to sort of prove that the process could really work with the producers and the other members of the creative teams.
So let's go then back to before the luxurious position you're in now.
Yeah.
And we'll go midway back.
Yes.
Because we'll go back to Rent a little bit. Because from the stories that I heard, Rent was like bouncing around every producer's desk. The demo cassette was lying all over town. Jonathan was like really pitching it. Really, it was going nowhere for a long time. And then all of a sudden it found its home.
What happened was that Jim Nicola, who's an extraordinary producer, responded to that material and saw all of its potential and was able to look past a lot of its roughness and a lot of its flaws because he saw at the core of it something he cared about deeply, but probably more importantly, something that Jonathan Larson cared about very, very deeply. And he was interested, I think, as Jim always is, as giving artists opportunities to express themselves.
When you first got a glimpse at it, how different was it from the piece that we now know and love? Like, how much did it grow?
A lot of, it certainly grew, but so many of its most extraordinary parts were there. You know, Light My Candle was completely there, and I remember reading that the first time and listening to it the first time and thinking, this is terrific, and what a fantastic way to introduce this relationship. Another Day was there completely. Some version of I'll Cover You was there. I mean, lots and lots of the great, great, great songs were there. And there was also a lot of other material that needed to go away and did. And then some material that was replaced that Jonathan wrote much, much better versions of. You know, the Take Me or Leave Me was about the fourth song Jonathan wrote for that slot in Act Two for Maureen and Joanne. And he didn't write it until we were about 2, maybe 3 weeks into rehearsal for the production in 95. We also did a workshop together in 94. That song, even that position for that song didn't exist in the workshop for 94. Jonathan wisely understood, I'll speak a little out of turn. He understood that the beautiful, beautiful Without You needed to be Roger and Mimi's song. And when that became Roger's and Mimi's song, there became a need for Maureen and Joanne to express themselves, but not in that kind of romantic way, but in an argumentative way. And so he wrote a lot of argument songs, and it took a while. And again, and I think with the incredible inspiration of Freddie Walker and Idina Menzel to write Take Me or Leave Me. And when he did, Tim Weil, our extraordinary, extraordinary music director, and I just, you know, flipped. And certainly Freddie and Idina flipped, and, you know, that song got learned and staged probably in 2 hours when it finally got there.
Wow.
And that staging has really remained.
So I want to talk a little hypothetically, obviously. Do you think, unfortunately, we all know that Jonathan passed away tragically. Do you think there was stuff he would have continued to do going forward?
Oh, of course. Oh, absolutely. I mean, and the story I just told is an indication of that. You know, his work was getting better and better. We had a really, really thorough, deep process through Rent. And I think he was really looking forward to writing lots more musicals and having lots more processes like that. And, you know, and he was really at the top of his game. If you look at Take Me or Leave Me, which is just, you know, a thrilling theater song.
Let's switch gears to Dear Evan Hansen, mm-hmm. and talk about the same type of process, because I saw one of the very early readings of that.
Uh-huh.
And I remember being taken by the music, but I also remember being like, wow, what a challenging story. I'm not sure if a commercial audience will ever take to this. I think there was an ensemble involved at the time. Was there more people involved?
There was briefly an ensemble, although when I first started talking about the show, and probably because of Next to Normal, I thought this would be great to do with a very small amount of people. And we also have the opportunity to have all of those other voices just join us virtually. You know, that component of the musical was always there. You know, the incredible song, which is now You Will Be Found, had another song in its place when I first encountered the material that you certainly listened to when you saw that reading. And we actually performed in D.C. It was called A Part of Me. And a part of me was the reaction of the community to Connor's death, similar to what you now see in You Will Be Found, although the focus has moved on to Evan instead of Connor. But there was always a component of the world weighing in on this event. And I think one of the first things I talked about was what a great opportunity to bring in, you know, media and the virtual world in a completely organic way. We don't need people to do it. Then we examined what would happen if some of that virtual community were represented with actual people. And then after that workshop, the incredibly smart writers said, no, let's go back to basics and really keep it tight. So That's what happened.
As I actually listen to you talk about that, I'm thinking about all of your canon or your body of work, which, you know, most of our biggest hits on Broadway are big hits, are the Phantoms and the Les Mis and the Lion Kings and the Wicked, these giant spectacles. And yours have all been small.
They've been sort of family dramas.
Yeah.
With music.
And that really is bucking the trend. You know, some other Broadway statistician once told me, Ken, you want a big Broadway hit, you got to make it a big hit. It's got a huge scene. It's got to be spectacle. How have you managed to buck that trend?
I just think I've been really fortunate to be connected to really great stories with really accessible, flawed, but identifiable characters. I think theater is really about seeing yourself up there. And I think people really want to identify with those characters or identify with a former part of their history when they were that character. And also, in the case of musicals, sensationally told by really, really great composers. You know, if I think of, you know, Justin and Benj, and I think of Tom Kitt and Brian Yorkey and Jonathan Larson, I feel very fortunate that I've gotten to work with some extraordinary, extraordinary composers. I've also done a lot of work with Scott Frankel and Michael Corey, and I think their work is extraordinary too.
So let's go back to the beginnings of your career. Uh-huh. How did you get started?
I directed terrible musicals in high school. And I probably wanted to be an actor, but I probably had too many self-esteem issues to actually like to be seen. But I certainly, I didn't go to the theater a lot, but I was always very drawn to it and to sort of alternative lives. I guess I was just a very typical, you know, unhappy gay boy in the early 60s, 70s in Brooklyn. So it was, I think, a very natural extension that I would be drawn to that area. I had an older sister who very sadly passed away, who was interested in theater, and she exposed me to a lot of things. I also have a living sister who lives in Florida, so I don't want to leave her out. But, you know, when I was way too young, I had a lot of exposure to, like, Hair. And a lot of really great plays on PBS. I mean, it was really like that. We were certainly a very working class family. We probably went to the theater once a year. I saw Hello Dolly. I saw like that big musical once a year, and we'd sit way up high, and I liked that. But a lot of the exposure really came from television, and it came from my sister's influence. And so by the time I was in high school, you know, I was looking for a place to belong. And this was the 70s in the New York City high school system. And they had these original musicals called Sing that essentially involved hundreds of students. There'd be, you know, an acting group that told a story. There were like 10 or 15 of those people. Then there was a dancing troupe. The 15 of the best looking women in, you know, the cheerleaders became dancers, and they were very popular. And then there were like 100 other women who were in a chorus. These were really big. It was about community. The shows were about community. And because it was the 70s, they had very idealized plots about making the world a better place and living in peace and protecting the earth. All the things we should still be talking about now, and sometimes we do, and too often we don't. And I began directing them. And essentially what we did is we stole popular musicals of the time and added our own terrible lyrics and our terrible story to them. So they'd have big opening numbers. I think, like, you know, one of our big opening numbers was Magic to Do. Another big opening number was Brand New Day from The Wiz. You know, we stole from the musicals of the time. I don't want to get Sing into too much trouble, but believe me, it was all done with $1.10, and, you know, tickets were free. And then the classes would compete against one another. And then if you won, the schools would compete against one another, you know, because it's American, has to all be a competition or else it's not interesting. So we did that. And I felt really good about that. And so by the time I went into college, I sort of believed that I would be interested in directing. I went to Northwestern. I went there because I wasn't really ready to commit to a professional life in the theater. I didn't know that I would make it. I continue to have those esteem issues. You know, when Northwestern was great because I could study liberal arts as well as theater. When I got to Northwestern, I realized I could also study something called oral interpretation, which is now called performance studies, which was a great, great program of study that had an incredible faculty, including Frank Galati. And Mary Zimmerman was my classmate. So people who are doing the most extraordinary, innovative theater work were around and doing that kind of work or laying the seeds for that kind of work back then in the late 70s, early 80s when I was around. Bruce Norris was a classmate of mine. I had a wonderful, wonderful group. And I loved my classes, and I loved the way in which especially the oral interpretation classes, now called performance study classes, you know, asked you as a performer to interpret material. We also adapted a lot of nonfiction, non-dramatic material, sometimes fiction, sometimes nonfiction, sometimes documentary to what we now call devised theater. So it was very engaging and very engaged. And by the time I finished, I had directed my obligatory production of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, and I loved Beckett, and I loved Stoppard, and I loved everyone you're supposed to love. And I thought I might actually stay in Chicago and try to have a go of becoming a part of a theater collective. And while I was in Chicago, I also got to see Steppenwolf's early work, the extraordinary production of Baum and Gilead that came to New York and made them, you know, nationally known. I got to see in Chicago all the time. And I saw a lot of their work in Chicago. So I thought I might stay in Chicago. I got an opportunity from a friend from high school to actually become an assistant director in New York. I took that opportunity. And once I hit New York, I realized that I needed more training, and I started looking for graduate programs. And I'd actually heard from Olympia Dukakis. Strangely, I ran into someone while waiting to see Cats in London who knew Olympia Dukakis, and I told her I was interested in directing. And she said, my friend Olympia, you know, works at NYU. And I've gotten to know Olympia since then, and I love Olympia very much and think the world of her. I had a little interview with Olympia, and she said, you know, NYU is discontinuing their directing program. I wouldn't advise you to go there. But the year I might have gone there was also the year that David S. Bjornson and Tony Kushner went there as directors. I applied to Yale. I got waitlisted. I applied to UCSD because Alan Schneider was teaching directing there. And as I said, I'd love Beckett. And I thought, you know, I was going to direct things like Beckett. And so I was very excited to have the opportunity to work with Alan. And I interviewed with Alan and a wonderful acting teacher who's died recently named Arthur Wagner. And I think because I was just like very New York too, they really took to me. And I found I had once again some incredible mentors at UCSD. And it really was at UCSD that I felt like it was clear that I was well liked and people believed in me. In my very first year in graduate school, I heard that Des Makinoff was taking over the La Jolla Playhouse. I had seen a number of really excellent productions Des had done at the Public Theater. Certainly all through college, whenever I'd come back to New York, I'd wait on that half-price tickets line or quick ticks line or whatever it was called at the Public at the time. And I saw everything at the Public, and the Public was doing the work that I most admired, you know, certainly in New York or yeah, certainly in New York, because there's also the Guthrie that I really respected at the time. Anyway, so I knew Des's work, and I was sort of like one of the few people in San Diego, certainly one of the few people in my program who did. And I actually became the house manager for the first season of the La Jolla Playhouse, which was an unbelievable season. Peter Sellers did the Visions of Simone Richard. Robert Woodruff directed a play. Des directed Romeo and Juliet in a play of Barry Keefe's. And by the time we did Romeo and Juliet, I became Des's assistant, and I remained his assistant for a number of years. So I was getting an incredibly diverse kinds of influences, which all sort of were stewing really well. You know, Alan was talking about Beckett, and Alan was talking about Albee, and Des can talk about anything and should, and I was feeling really supported in the program, but I was also meeting Peter Sellers and Robert Woodruff and the incredible directors that Des was bringing out to the Playhouse, whose work mainly I'd seen in New York, but to be close up and to watch processes. I just, grad school for me was really, 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 really formative and important.
You said when you got to New York, you quickly knew that you needed more education.
Yes.
What gave you that indication?
It's really just about like, you know, how much can you put yourself out there? I just wasn't ready. I knew I couldn't put myself out there. You know, I could have stage managed, I could have assisted, but I didn't really see the way I was going to make the leap. Both from a confidence perspective and a sort of a practical reality by looking around and seeing who was getting work and who wasn't getting work. But it was sort of a good combination of both. I certainly have a lot of regard for some people who've come right out of undergrad and make it. I think that's fantastic, but I knew it wasn't for me. And I always tell people who are asking me about that people have different paths. This path was, I certainly needed more lab incubation support to start to sell my wares. And because on some level, you really, really do at some point need to sell your wares. And should we jump to that chapter?
Yes. Let's talk about selling shit.
When I got out of graduate school, I had a number of good contacts. There were a number of programs that were giving emerging directors opportunities. One of them was the TCG Fellowship, which is a little different than it is now, although that still exists. And really the most sought after program in the city at the time was the New York Theater Workshop New Directors Project, which doesn't exist anymore. Gene Passanante started it. I think it lasted about 5 or 6 years. What Jim did is he took all of the alums of that directing project and he turned us into what are now called the usual suspects. So we were always an advisory group and we met with Jim and talked about projects we wanted to do. And the New York Theater Workshop has always been extraordinary about providing opportunities for early career directors, and they continue to be, which is remarkable. So I was fortunate to become a part of this new director's project. As I said, Gene Passanante was running the workshop at the time. Tony Kushner was her associate. Tony and I met each other like back in 1984, maybe even earlier. And as I said, because I knew we were in graduate school at the same time, there was sort of some little communication, like Facebook didn't exist, but there was some little contact between like emerging directors at the time. I didn't know that he was a playwright at the time. I was accepted into that project. I did a play called 70 Scenes of Halloween. It was a good opportunity to show off a little as a director because what it had 70 short scenes all inhabited by 4 characters. And the reality and the tone would shift from short scene to short scene. And the playwright, Jeffrey Jones, in a foreword that I took very seriously, said, I want every director to actually take the opportunity to order the scenes in whatever way you want to order them. So there was a lot of dramaturgy and writing involved in the directing of that project as well. That project went well, and I got a wonderful agent named Helen Merrill out of it, who a lot of early career directors got to know back in the day. And at some point she started working with a man named Patrick Herold, who remains my agent today. But I also, you know, then had this period where I was getting a little regional work, but I was certainly not getting the next job in New York. And because I was frustrated about not getting the work in New York, I followed some advice that Michael Weller gave me when I was a graduate student. He said, you just need to put your own work up. No one's going to hire you. Put your own work up. Well, very, very fortunately, I had become the associate and tour director of Big River after assisting Des on it for a number of years. I brought it to Australia, where it was ridiculously popular and lasted much longer than anyone imagined it would last, and that gave me some money. I did a bus and truck of it. So I had a little money from my commercial theater exposure. This also, you know, puts me in very good stead when Jonathan asks the inevitable question of, yeah, but has he ever directed a musical? which he, of course, posits to Jim Nicol. And Jim says, yes, in fact, go to Australia. He's very popular as a musical director there. Anyway, so a number of years pass after the New York Theatre Workshop, and I'm getting some work out of town, and I'm getting good jobs regionally, but I can't get into any of the theaters I want to get into. So I take Michael's advice, and very fortunately, I'm able to self-produce, along with the very wonderful Jody Markell and Naked Angels Theater, a production of Machinal. And Jody was someone I met in college, and Jody was brilliant enough, as she still is, to get the rights to Machinal because she loved that part. And she invited me to direct it, and it was a large show. There were about 15 people in it. There was a moment where we were going to do it at the Equity Library Theater. The Equity Library Theater closed after I got the invitation to work there, of course. That's a whole other story that I shouldn't dwell on or talk about because I don't really know all the facts at all. But anyway, because there was a production sort of in mind already, Jody and I decided to ask the theater group that she was connected to, Naked Angels, if they would house us. And they agreed, provided that we could produce it, meaning pay for it. And so we paid for a showcase. I think it was probably $20,000 or something like that. And this was really successful. And I think because my friend David Warren worked at the Public at the time, I think he came with Kevin Klein to see it, which was, I think, an act of friendship. And Kevin Klein really liked it. And then Kevin Klein invited Joe Papp to see it. And I mean, I honestly remember, you know, having to go to the box office to say, it's very important that Joe Papp has a good seat. And they were like, who's Joe Papp? And we were sold out. And I don't know if we can get him a seat. I mean, that really happened. So Joe Papp came and saw this production of Machinal that Jody and I produced, that she was at the center of, with a lot of wonderful Naked Angel actors. Joe saw that production, and then Joe called me, and that was like completely life-changing and very, very, very unexpected. Joe called and said, I'd love you to come in and talk about being a resident director here. And what that means is I'll give you about $1 million and you can produce and direct, you know, one show, two shows. I think you should do three shows. And I mean, it was...
Yeah, what was your response to that one?
But, you know, you sit there and go, yes, that would be good. I'd like that. But it was beyond, you know, a dream come true. And it was really, I mean, that's the moment for me. I know that when people look at, you know, my life in the commercial theater, it's Rent. But for me, it was all about Machinal and what that did in terms of making me, allowing Joe Papp and the rest of New York City to see me as a director.
All because you put your money where your talent is.
Yeah. And when Michael Weller told me to do that, I was really very frustrated. And I think that's not the way it should work. You shouldn't have to do that. It shouldn't be about privilege. But I'm very happy to say that for me, it wasn't about privilege. It was about being fortunate enough to, you know, wisely collect some money and be able to invest it wisely when at the right time. So I did a couple of years as an associate director at the Public Theater, and very, very, very sadly, but not surprisingly, you know, Joe was very ill, and then Joe died during that residency. But I worked closely with George Wolfe and David Greenspan and Joanna Galaitis, and that's very thrilling. And because of Machinal, you know, which Jonathan and some of his friends saw, both at Naked Angels and the Public, you know, I became a possible director for this musical, Rent.
So it all really stems back to that one production.
You know, and yeah, I mean, everything leads to everything, but if there was a turning point, if there was a marker, it's certainly that.
You obviously started your career not only being a student of plays, but a lover of plays. I can hear it in your voice. You talk about Beckett. And now you're known for these big commercial musicals.
Yeah, or small commercial musicals.
Small commercial musicals, right, with big box office numbers.
Yeah.
Do you miss plays? Do you want to do more plays?
Yeah. I also feel unbelievably fortunate as I really go back and forth. Before we started our interview, I said I'm about to go do a new play of Michael Ristoffer's at the Huntington called Man in the Ring. Last season, I was really, really thrilled to do Bruce Norris's epic, brilliant The Low Road at the Public. I've gotten to work at the Delacorte on Shakespeare a number of times, and I look forward to more opportunities to that. And I'd certainly like to do plays on Broadway. People, you know, I think people know that I'd like to do plays on Broadway.
Do you read reviews?
Uh-huh.
And why?
I feel like I'm the one who really needs to be the link. You know, I'm the one who really needs to understand what the work I've done with the actors and the rest of the creative team. I'm the one who really needs to be responsible for how it's ultimately received. So I feel like it's really an important part of my responsibility. Sometimes it'll take me a day or two, or I'll actually ask someone to, like, let me know about the good ones first. But ultimately, I do read them all, and I really do I take them very seriously.
You've also worked with some of the best producers the industry has.
Yes.
Kevin and Jeffrey, of course, on Rent, David Stone. How do you describe the best producer-director relationship? What do you look for from producers?
I really look for a collaborator. I really look for someone. I feel like the best projects really begin with producers putting a team together. And often, you know, there are certainly opportunities where I put a team together, but I've been really fortunate for when, you know, David Stone or Stacey Mindich have put a team together, and I've, you know, recognized the incredible wisdom of how we all got there. So I think a lot of it starts with that. In the case of David, you know, I think some of the things we've done have been like his idea, you know, and he's like, I'm looking for a group of people who can execute this idea, you know, see how will you be inspired by this idea. What I'm looking for really in the trenches is someone who's going to, you know, believe in me and trust me and certainly question me and certainly challenge me, but also someone who's going to recognize that I'm doing something that's unique, you know, that we directors have a real unique thing to bring to the process as well.
You've obviously been a part of some big, big hits, but not everything can be a big, big hit. When something misses slightly or in a big way and it doesn't get the response that you thought it might, how do you pick yourself up from that?
It varies. A lot of it has to do with if you're really confused by the response.
We were talking about that just before we started.
Yes, I think when you're confused by the response, it takes longer. If you know, there's that little, you know, sweat running down the back of your neck that sort of in some way precedes the sort of dousing that you later get. In some ways, I don't know, maybe that's just ego. Maybe that's easier because you can feel like, I understand how that happened, or I saw that coming, or I know we weren't really hitting it. But sometimes it's confusing, and those are tougher.
Is there any show that you'd love to go of yours that you'd love to go back and direct again? If you had another shot at it?
Well, yeah, this is dangerous to say, but I've said it before. Bright Lights, Big City is a really, really, really is a musical with really great music and a really complicated story. And I don't know that it could work. And I honestly think what I've come to believe is if a character is flawed or inaccessible in a way that can't let an audience really root for him or her, that it's really rough. And even like, and I'm not talking about, you know, The Demon Barber of Fleet Street is exquisitely written, and you can completely understand and go on the journey with him, as twisted as it is, and certainly with Mrs. Lovett. So I'm not saying everyone has to be nice or good, but certainly, you know, Paul has yet to Paul Scott Goodman, the really, really, really talented composer of Bright Lights, Big City, hasn't yet, you know, found a way to introduce that, sustain that character in a way that he becomes someone that you can really follow and really identify with. But I do think about getting back to it, and people have heard me say that, and Paul has heard me say that, so it's not, you know, my phone won't be ringing when after this is aired.
Well, as a secret fan of that show, I would love to see you get back to that.
Well, that's very nice that you're a secret fan of it. And it has its fans, and I think that's very meaningful to Paul and very meaningful to me. And, you know, some really great contemporary composers, and I'll let you figure out who those people are, really like that musical.
What's your relationship like with actors during the process? Do you...
I think it's really good, and I think it's important for it to be really good. I think that it's I think it starts with actually a lot of respect for what they do. I think maybe because I was a rotten actor myself, I also was partnered with an actor. I no longer live with him, but we were together for a lot of decades, so I understood what his life was like. But I also think actors, I think we go to the theater to see the actors interpret the material. you know, of course it's all about the material ultimately, but the first line of communication are the actor. And I think when people go to the theater, they see the people up there and they see what they're doing. So I think they carry that responsibility, and we have a tremendous responsibility to them to give them every possible tool to do their absolute best.
You get a chance to see a lot of theater, obviously read a lot of theater and projects that you say yes or no to. What's the one thing, the most common, for lack of a better word, mistake you see in shows from a writing perspective and also from a directorial perspective? Some commonality that you see emerging artists that they could improve on?
I mean, in some ways, it touches on some of the things we talked about before the interview began. I feel like there's some mistaken notion that, you know, Broadway needs to be, you know, as accessible as, you know, the biggest studio movie. You know, I don't think it has to appeal to everyone. I think it has to be, you know, about something and somewhat challenging to be really well loved. And I sometimes believe people are just trying to make material that much more accessible and likable than they need to. And that's, I don't feel like that makes for the best work.
All right. My last question, which is my genie question. I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to visit you.
Okay.
And wants to thank you for your contribution.
He's very noisy.
Yes, he gets a big entrance. Wants to thank you for your contribution to the American musical theater and the theater as a whole by granting you one wish. What's the one thing about Broadway that drives you so crazy, so mad, so frustrates you that you'd ask this genie to wish away in an instant?
I'm really such a pragmatist. I never really think of things like that. You know, I mean, certainly I'd like for all the ticket prices to be $35 all the time for everyone. So maybe that was what I'd wish for.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you for joining us. And thanks to all of you for listening. We will see you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.